they worked hard in the 50s defending the rights of labor to organize. And in the last 10 years, the ACLU, and along with the ICLU, has been active in defending rights of minorities and of groups who haven't been, which haven't been given full recognition of their rights in our society, particularly the rights of blacks, the rights of other ethnic groups, the rights of women, and the rights of students.
Mr. Cranberg said that you were quite an expert on the rights of women. Could you briefly tell us your experience with women's rights and your knowledge of women's rights?
Well, if you want to know most of what I want to know about women's rights, you have to read my book, Strong-Minded Women, which was published by Iowa State University Press several years ago, which is a history of the women's rights movement in Iowa. Not of the women's rights movement, of the women's suffrage movement. I don't know how I got started, excepting that I was active in the League of Women Voters, and I was interested in finding out who were the founders of the League of Women Voters, because the League of Women Voters was a direct outgrowth of the women's suffrage movement. And when I was asked to give a talk on women in Iowa, I began to do a little searching into the history, and I got so fascinated with reading old newspapers and old letters and all kinds of things like this, and digging up stories about the suffrage movement that had never been, that had been suppressed because it was just too painful for the participants at the time. I ended up by writing this book. Now, when I started out in, with this book about with the research in 1960, I just thought the women's rights movement was something that began in 1848 with the Seneca Falls Convention and ended in 1920 when women got the vote. And essentially, this was true, because after 1920, the women's rights movement had, this was kind of spent, and there really wasn't much of a one. But by the time I finished writing the book, I suddenly discovered there was a great resurgence of the women's rights movement, and here I was, an expert in the history of the movement, and of course vitally interested in what was going on, so that I was more than happy to become active in it. My real involvement with women's rights really came, first place, through my membership on the board of the American Civil Liberties Union. As a representative of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, I was a member for several years of the board of national board of the ACLU, which meets five times a year in New York. This is a board of about 80 people, and I think that probably when I was on the board, there may have been five women and 75 men. And outside of myself, at least, Dorothy Kenyon and Pauline Murray and Harriet Philpell, maybe, I don't remember there's any other, were lawyers, and very brilliant lawyers. And the men were either lawyers or very vocal college professors or somebody that had specialized in a certain branch of civil liberties issues. And so I never sat on a board where I was absolutely silent for so long. But I was completely cowed by these very bright and very vocal people. And furthermore, I really had nothing to add. I had a lot to learn. Finally, I began to realize that there were two women on the board, Pauline Murray and Dorothy Kenyon, who died just recently. She was, Dorothy Kenyon was a judge in New York City, a very brilliant woman, a great libertarian, a woman who had stood up to McCarthy during the McCarthy era when she was called before his committee in Washington. And they were, the first issue that I can really recall was their fighting to get the ACLU to endorse the Equal Rights Amendment. And the committee had a study committee had recommended that the ACLU endorse the Equal Rights Amendment. And so there was this discussion at board meeting, the labor man on the board, Mr. Samuels, was very much against it. He felt that the Equal Rights Amendment would really do a great deal of harm to protective labor laws for women. And Polly Murray and Dorothy Kenyon were the leaders in the other side. I won't go into the arguments pro and con, because those you can get from reading almost any literature on debates on the Equal Rights Amendment. Well, anyway, it looked as though it was all going fine until one man got up and he said, what are you going to do? Are you going to make everybody go to the same washroom? And I don't know how many other things. And the vote went completely against support of the Equal Rights Amendment at that point. I'm not quite sure what year that was. But I began to realize, you know, I was with these women and I voted with them. And I think I was about one of the three or four people that did. That here was one area that I really knew more about and cared more about than all these male members of the board. And so gradually, I think through Polly Murray and Dorothy Kenyon, I became sensitized to these issues and began to be a little bit vocal about them on the board. So that by the time my term on the board was up, I was becoming a rather vocal defender, at least in that area.
You think, you mentioned this earlier, Equal Rights Amendment, which the ACLU did not support. Do you think they'll support the amendment which is before the state legislatures at this time?
I should have said that it was more than a year, or within 2 years after this defeat on the board, the ACLU did go on record in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment. And as a matter of fact, the ACLU has a biennial conference every 2 years, and the conference in 1970, there was a women's caucus that kind of sprang up when the question of women's rights came up at one of the meetings, and the women got together after a session and made a list of things that they thought the ACLU should stand for in the area of women's rights, and asked for special time at the meeting in order to present this list. And they were given the time, and the issues were voted on. And in a way, I thought it was done in a most insulting way, because nobody argued. The things were just read off, and everybody said yes, you know, like, well, give the women what they want and get them out of the way. And I said something to Polly Murray afterwards. Polly Murray is a lawyer and a professor at Brandeis University, and a woman who does not like to be called black. She calls herself a Negro. Very active in women's rights. And I said, you know, they just don't take it seriously at all. She says, yes, but they will. And I think the results are showing this year. The ACLU board voted for the year 1972 to make women's rights one of their top priority issues. And they now have just set up a special project on women's rights with a woman who is a professor at, I think, Columbia, maybe Harvard. I'm not sure whether she divides her time. And somebody working under her. These are lawyers who are going to work in this area.
Yeah. Mrs. Ann, I know when I've heard you speak earlier, you've mentioned that you've often had trouble getting like girls to stand up for their, like, say, pregnant girls to stand up for their rights to go to court because it's somewhat embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, could you elaborate on that and tell what finally happened? I know didn't you finally get a girl that would go all the way through the court?
No, we never did.
You never did?
But, well, this is an area that I've been interested in just as a feminist, because it just seems so wrong to just automatically put girls out of school because they're pregnant. Now, this is the old morality kind of thing, that you punish the girl, but nothing happens to the boy. And actually, who needs an education more than a pregnant girl who very likely may never get any further schooling after she's had her baby? So the first thing the Iowa Civil Liberties Union did in that area was something that I suggested, and that was a statewide survey of the rules or how the schools throughout the state handled this problem of pregnant girls, both married and unmarried, and also what rules they had concerning married students. And somewhere I have a note on that. I can't give you the exact date now, but we did get a pretty clear picture of the fact that while the rules varied a good deal, inevitably there was some kind of a penalty for every pregnant girl, and at that time for most married students. But married students were allowed to go to school. They just weren't allowed to attend a prom or be in extracurricular activities of some kind. But as far as I know, I think the Des Moines schools still have a rule that a pregnant girl is not permitted to attend a regular school. She's permitted to go to some kind of special school for pregnant girls. Now, this is not anywhere near equal to the kind of schooling she gets in her regular school, and it also makes her, I keep thinking of the Scarlet Letter. These girls, maybe they'd let them wear a Scarlet Letter, they'd let them go to school. There was a girl in southeastern Iowa last year that the Civil Liberties Union had offered to defend, but she had made her own arrangements with a lawyer, and she did go to court over her right to go to school. She was married, she was pregnant, she lived right across the street from school. She had to go across the street and get her lessons and go home and study them. This case was settled out of court finally, so that there was never any judicial decision on the right to pregnant girls to go to school. This winter, a young woman came to the Iowa Civil Liberties Union for help. She was a student nurse in the School of Nursing at a public hospital in Iowa, and she was asked to leave because she was pregnant and unmarried. If she had been married and pregnant, she could have stayed. The Iowa Civil Liberties Union was willing to take this case to court, but the girl felt, because of her parents, she didn't want the publicity going along with it. So I called the director of the hospital who was very cooperative, and we called a meeting of the board of trustees of the hospital and talked with the board of trustees, and the board reversed the policy of the hospital, and the girl was not only asked to come back to school, but invited back into the dormitory, and so that case was settled very happily, at least as far as the girl was concerned.
We have, so far, we've progressed from women's rights to students' females' rights. So I'd say the next question would be logical, and just plain students' rights, and more specifically, a case which is somewhat important to Marcia and I, since we do go to Roosevelt. That's the Tinker armband case. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. My first contact with this case was one evening back in, I suppose it was 1965, when they were. The father of one of these students called me and said that the students had been thinking about wearing black armbands to school, and that the administration had threatened to send them home if they did wear armbands, and would the Civil Liberties Union defend these kids if they were expelled from school? And I said, well, I couldn't speak for the Civil Liberties Union, but I certainly thought it was a case we'd be interested in, and in all likelihood, we probably would do whatever we could. And little did I know that that was the beginning of a case that was going to end up in a landmark decision in the United States Supreme Court. as you know, the so-called Tinker case, and the children were sent home, and the Civil Liberties Union did defend them, and we lost in the lower courts, and it was appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And the decision was, not only was a favorable decision, but it turned into a landmark decision. You can't read any kind of literature about student rights now that they don't refer to the Tinker decision. I was reading in the current issue of the Civil Liberties paper, ACLU paper, I don't know where it is, but anyway, they're complaining that in spite of all Tinker, in spite of the Tinker case, in spite of other such decisions, that schools are not really abiding by these decisions. They're not fully, implementing them. I think we're more aware of student rights probably in Des Moines because of this case. But in looking over the old clippings, I discovered one quoting the president of the school board, Mr. Niffeniger, who said at that time that the students, all the excitement about the students wearing the armbands, he says, "We're running an educational institution, and I don't think this is any part of it. Our country's leaders have decided on a course of action, and we should support them." It's hard to remember the emotion over the Vietnam War at that time. The war was not unpopular then. It was something we were in, and anybody who disagreed with our war policy was very unpopular, and it was a highly emotional issue. Another issue we got into at that time, this has nothing to do with student rights, but it does have to do with the war issue, which is the draft card burning students at the University of Iowa. And I can remember meeting with the board of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, should we defend a draft card burner? Well, we finally decided that we weren't sure that he had a right to burn his draft card. On the other hand, he was so unpopular, this student that had done it, that he couldn't get a lawyer. No lawyer would defend him. So on the basis that the issue presented constitutional questions that needed to be explored, and on the basis that anybody who is involved in any kind of an issue, no matter whether it's unpopular or not, deserves the right for adequate representation, the Iowa Civil Liberties Union did provide counsel for this student.
Mrs. M, before you mentioned that, you know, that the Civil Liberties Union is made up of so many individualistic people, have there been any periods of just great dispute within the union where you just really couldn't come to a decision?
Well, the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, I guess maybe we're not quite as as many individualists or a little more peaceable, but since I've been chairman, I haven't known any really dissension within the board at all. In fact, sometimes I have a feeling things are so peaceable that there's something wrong. We should be arguing more. The one case where we couldn't come to any decision was over what to do about the Amish.
Yeah.
The Amish students who were taught by their own Amish people, and the girls would teach them, or usually girls with an eighth grade education, and I forget where it was, but someplace in the state, the authorities had decided these children had to have certified teachers, and that they would be taken to into the regular school system rather than going to Amish schools. And the Civil Liberties Union, in fact, I started out believing that these youngsters had a right to a decent education by my terms, and that their right to an education really was more important than the parents' religious rights to keep their children in these small schools with just a minimum of education, a formal education. We argued this out over in the Civil Liberties Union Board a number of times. We just finally agreed not to agree. But it never was done with, you know, any really lot of vigor. I was saying real dissension in the Asia you came over, how to handle, well, the Spock case, it all really came to a culmination, and I understand that Mr. Cranberg has talked about that. I might just say here parenthetically that when I first became active in the American Civil Liberties Union, the board, the ACLU board, was a group of people who lived in the New York area, a small group who were dedicated civil libertarians, and who decided the ACLU policy. And they had done this because over the years, it was, you know, transportation wasn't as available as it is today for flying from the west coast of New York in a few hours and so forth. So it had to be a group that could meet in New York. Well, about sometime in the late 60s, there was kind of a revolution in the ACLU. Felt that maybe this New York board was not really representing the whole spectrum of civil liberties throughout the country. And there was a demand for more representation on the board. At the time that the Spock case was debated, the board had been enlarged to include one representative from every affiliate. And I think the ACLU board expenses were maybe for, I don't know, a few meetings a year, and then it was expanded to more. But I remember that I did go to the board meetings when the Spock case was debated because I was just so interested in the whole area. And at that time, I guess I wasn't really as developed my civil liberties thinking as I am today, or maybe it was just that the arguments on both sides were so persuasive I could really have voted on either side of that question. As far as it wasn't a question of whether they should get into the Spock case, it was a question of how they should get into it, whether by an amicus brief or direct representation. And I voted with the minority in that case, which was to go in with an amicus brief.
What is that in second?
Well, that's instead of being a party to the case or giving direct representation and representing the client, somebody else represents the client, and you come in with a so-called friend of the court brief, which is arguing the point that you want to make in a particular issue.
In our research, we noticed that there's a general trend toward a different type of case in the American Civil Liberties Union, such as toward defending the rights of homosexuals, etc. Has the Iowa Civil Liberties Union noticed such a trend toward the stranger type of cases?
Well, I don't think they're stranger types of cases. They're just, as I said, the Civil Liberties Union in the last years is representing groups that have never been represented before. To any great extent, such as when I mentioned minority groups, I could well have mentioned homosexuals with those groups whose rights have never been really represented by anybody. We have not gotten into any cases, although we did have two male homosexuals ask us to defend their right to be married. And I can't remember what happened to the case. Here's a case again of or a question of getting a lawyer to take a case like that, and with a lawyer having to give his time, it isn't always easy to get somebody to represent cases that are issues that are essentially maybe pretty unpopular yet. But of course, this is what makes the Civil Liberties Union, why people call it often, a left-wing organization or a organization that defends only kooks. If you're just a common, ordinary citizen who does what everybody else does, you're not apt to get into much trouble. You aren't going to want anything out of the unusual, and nobody's really going to probably jump on you very much for anything, and so you're not very likely to come to the Civil Liberties Union for help. But if you're taking an unpopular point of view, a stand like the Tinker Children did when the war was when it was not popular to criticize the war, or if you're a homosexual in a society which considers homosexuals very queer and outcast, and you defend this kind of person, then it isn't that we're defending either the war or the fact that people should or should not be homosexual. All we're defending is their right to express their opinions when it comes to the war, or their right to live their own private lives the way they want to, as long as they aren't impinging on somebody else's life.
Since you're defending so many different types of groups, could you tell us how one would contact the Civil Liberties Union to get their help in their case? And
well, the Iowa Civil Liberties Union is listed in the Des Moines directory, and all you have to do is call our office. And the main problem is that since we're a relatively poor organization, we do not have anybody at the office full time, and so that you have to call the office when somebody's there, which is generally Herbert Kelly, our executive secretary, is there Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and very often, much more often than that. And I get calls, people call me who have known my name through the Civil Liberties Union. We have branches in northeast Iowa, at Waterloo, in Iowa City, and in Sioux City. I'm not sure whether those affiliates have telephone listings or not.
Okay, in today's day and age, more and more young people are becoming interested in the rights of others and the rights, well, just the rights of everybody. Could you, like, give advice for a person who would want to go into the area of civil liberties as to what they should do and, I mean, how they could get into this area?
Well, the Civil Liberties Union has traditionally been oriented toward court cases and this approach to defending rights of people. And I suppose still, if anybody wants to get into the area of civil liberties, a legal background would be the number one requirement. Although there are other areas, there are people working in the legislative branch and actually Arie Nair, who's the executive director of the ACLU, is not a lawyer and is a brilliant person and does an excellent job. So a law degree is not a must, but I would say it would be desirable.
Well, that's really about all we had planned. Is there anything else you would like to say?
No, I enjoyed talking. I didn't realize I could talk this much about civil liberties at one point.
Well, thank you
for coming.
Thank you for your time.